open up a space for integration. And I, when Maricela, you know, invited me to speak, and it was, I think, probably like a couple hours after I had left an organizing meeting. And I'm like, of course, I know exactly what to talk about. It'll be very simple. It's very clean. It'll be great. And then, you know, a week has passed and it gets messier and messier and messier. And I still want to reflect and share a conversation with you about the Dharma and this moment that's really a focus on gun violence and gender-based violence and activism surrounding it. But I've noted that it's actually turned out for me to be much more about what this moment is teaching me about my practice than what my practice is teaching me about this moment. And so I'm Theravada in tradition and teaching, and I have challenged myself not to quote one sutta today. As you know, we're the bookworms of the bookworms of the Dharma groups. So, but I will be quoting quite a few bodhisattvas in our lives, who have really, I think, spearheaded global conversation of pieces of the Dharma that have really, for me, actually given greater meaning. So, just to get us all on the same page, when I talk about this moment, because, you know, I'm not going to get way too existential, but you know what is a moment? I'm not going to go there. I'm going to define a moment that I'm talking about, even though I recognize there are many moments happening in our lives at this time and in our bodies and in our communities. But the moment that I have been dedicating I've had the honor to support a lot of people in their work, and I've had the pleasure of engaging in some of the work myself, is this moment of how we as a nation are shifting what we accept as a form of violence. As we are turning towards almost a new ethic of safety and who deserves to be and where they deserve to be and what is violence. And these questions have really very much made the press recently in related to last week's march and related to the response, the national response to the shooting in Parkland and the students organizing the day after. And so, you know, February 14th, about 34 students and adults were shot, 17 did not survive. And it was a devastating tragedy for that community and the reverberations throughout the country. And then I say that in the context of the first Noble Truth of Suffering, that it was a pretty normal day for a lot of other people. Because on that day, 24 to 42, other teenagers under the age of 18 were shot across the country, just like an average day. 96 adults and children died that day by firearms, just like any other Day in our country. And the response that really pulled at my heartstrings, and I think many others, and definitely brought, I think, a big groundswell of attention, were the 911 calls, right? The 911 calls from so many young people hiding from their parents, begging the police to do something. And that was a response, in my opinion, that was based on their lived wisdom. Their lived wisdom that law enforcement comes to protect them. Their lived wisdom that they are entitled to such protection. And their lived wisdom that something's wrong if that doesn't work out. The shock that the armed officer on site never entered the building. The shock. The shock at the delay of the mechanics for communication to determine what was going on inside the school. The shock that there were, I can't even keep track now, 8, I think, different opportunities for there to be some intervention in this young man's life by government that may not have been taken advantage of. The shock. But for many, that wasn't shocking. And for those who were not shocked, there was a double pain of not seeing much resistance come from that action, from that tragedy, to highlight instead the question of, does law enforcement even keep us safe? It's a question many have held on to. There's a question many have felt it's clearly answered. School shootings in this country have stayed at the same rate over the last 10 years. They have not increased. They went down. It's about in school shootings. About, I think, 30 deaths a year. Over 900 deaths with a law enforcement officer at the trigger a year. Yet, state after state, city after city, Parkland, the first bill that went through, millions of dollars to get more law enforcement into their school, millions of dollars to get more guns into their school. Atlanta followed suit, $40 million into the school. The state is matching the DOJ, more money into the schools. We have corporations such as Axion, who benefited from 1 year's worth of federal aid to give free body cameras to law enforcement agencies, including those that are entering our schools, and now own every single image under corporate protection that is captured. And they're now introducing and just took over an artificial intelligence corporation and have complete control as to how those images are to be used. So many of us feel like we have allowed the wolf into the hen house. And that wolf has never shown that he or she's taking very good care of that hen house. The data is not coming up. But that's just data, back to lived experience. So then you look in the streets of what are called urban centers, like Baltimore, and the shootings here have a different response. One data point that was really interesting to me that I discovered was that a recent study of DC and Oakland, in the areas where they have, you know, the corporations are finding great ways to make money in response and anticipation of the growing tragedies that enter our lives. And so the shot calculator systems in DC and Oakland, in their years of their first studies, they determined their effectiveness by finding that actually gunshots were recorded, and in only 12% of those cases did anyone even report it. And so when we speak of gun violence, there are a few distortions that we deal with. One is the distortion of focusing on homicides rather than non-fatal shootings. I don't know if you come across it, but there's new evidence, it's not yet conclusive, that the majority of reductions in gun homicides, who do we have to thank? Have any of you read that stuff? Read these articles? Doctors. It's not the police. It's not even us. It's not as a community organizer. It's doctors. They keep people alive. You have to count gun shootings, not gun homicides, to really know what's happening in our cities. And when you look at that, it's devastating. It's devastating. So non-fatal shootings in certain spaces are starting to go up, and that is tied to so much of the challenges and the cravings that are happening within our communities and our society. If you really want to be depressed, so there's a lot that's showing that, you know, violence is associated with inequality. And then you're like, great, because I'm against inequality. So if we fight inequality, we can get rid of gun violence. And then the same study shows that the only levelers of inequality are like mass disasters, governmental uprisings, like complete changes of our entire system of government and our entire economic system. The tinkering is not giving us demonstrative results. And that's the world that I work in. I work with activists who keep me positive that there is still hope, that there is still action, that there is still a way forward. But it is my faith. I think it is my faith that recognizes I can hold all of these contradictions. That I can hold the contradiction that, yeah, some of this is tinkering. But it is making a record. It's making a record for history, and these moments. Are periodic, but what links them, and this is actually from the words of an organizer, Philip Agnew, said, what connects these movements is organizing. Movements are what connect these moments. The movements never die. Much like our spirit, our energy, our souls. They never die, but they are also ever changing and influenced by everything around them. So I wanted to go through a couple images. All right, so can y'all see
if I go like this?
Because I did not manage to get up onto this, but okay. So, we're not even going to start there. Actually, we're going to go way back. All right, we're going to start here. All right. Yeah, sure, pass it around. Anybody want to speak to that image, what that image means to you? Anyone familiar with it? Go ahead.
You missed my introduction, but I was feeling quiet.
Oh, I missed that introduction. I'm not going to talk. Anyone want to speak to? Mm-hmm. Anybody else? All right, so this is Sojourner Truth. This is delivered in 1851 Women's Convention in Ohio. This is why I didn't want to be recorded. I can't do it with her accent. But I just needed you to hear these words because I think when we think of these powerful icons, we think of how polished they must have been. And shoot, this is just, I just feel like this is someone I know down the street. She's like, okay. I think that twixt the Negroes of the South and the women of the North, all talking about rights, the white men will be in a fix pretty soon. But what's all this here talking about? That man over there says the women need to be helped into carriages and lifted over ditches and to have the best places everywhere. No better ever helps me into carriages or over mud puddles or gives me any best place. And ain't I a woman? Look at me. Look at my arm. Or gives me any best, or look at my arm. I have plowed and planted and gathered into barns and no man could heed me. And ain't I a woman? I could work as much and eat as much as a man when I could get it and bear the lash as well. And ain't I a woman? I have borne 13 children and seen most all sold off to slavery. And when I cried out with my mother's grief, none but Jesus heard me. And ain't I a woman? Then they talk about this thing in the head. What's this thing called? A member of the audience whispers, intellect. That's it, honey. What's that got to do with women's rights or Negroes, right? If my cup won't hold but a pint and yours holds a quart, wouldn't you be mean not to let me have my little half measure full? Then that little man in black there, he says, a woman can't have as much rights as men because Christ wasn't a woman. Where did your Christ come from? Where did your Christ come from? From God and a woman. Man had nothing to do with him. If the first woman God ever made was strong enough to turn the world upside down all alone, these women together ought to be able to turn it back and get it right side up again. And now they's asking to do it. The men better let them. Obliged to you for hearing me, and now old Sojourners ain't gonna go, nothing more to say. And with that, she was finished speaking. And what I love about the Sojourner speech is because we had this move with the hashtag MeToo moment. Does anybody know where MeToo started? Yeah. Turn on a Burt? Yeah. And so Toronto Burke was co-founder of an organization of gender girls, girls and gender, girls and gender equity. And essentially the group started, I think it was a petition out of coming out of public housing of women of color who wanted there to be closer attention to the sexual harm that they were experiencing. Women and girls of color. The Me Too was the Ain't I a Woman? For 10 years, they ran this campaign. And then the Me Too moment occurred when high profile celebrities, primarily white, began speaking out about offending men, primarily white, not all the women were white, but it was people in a lot more power than the folks who created the hashtag, but screw the hashtag. Who are living the suffering that was ignored. And then this happens. The Time magazine, where the press and the movement got smart enough to realize that, oh yeah, Me Too kind of was co-opted, so they put Tarana now in the front at least. She's there. She's engaging it gracefully because she recognizes, and this is where it is the how the movement helps me understand the Dharma. She's like, first of all, there is no ownership. One, no one owns suffering. No one owns a hashtag. It is a call to arms. It's a call to attention, and we're so happy that people heard. And there's a beauty in the generosity of her just continuing to do the work. And definitely, she's a good advocate. Leverage it. Leverage it. But continuing to do the work. And I think one of the key messages from the movement is about the sense of ownership that we don't want to own our suffering. When we particularly as marginalized individuals, and I believe so much has been stripped of us,
sometimes it feels like it is the only thing we have. Moral indignation over a sense of suffering and an attachment to it. And so I believe that the activists give us a very concrete example of what it means to let go of suffering, to not attach. It can feel so theoretical. And I just feel like the examples we see in the streets. Another is a dear friend of mine, organizer Max Ramon. When essentially, and I don't know if any of you got to read the article at all. Anybody read the Vox article? It's okay if you didn't. So there's an article that came out, let's see here, February 24th. So 10 days after the shooting. And I know that by that date, I'd been getting reports that a lot of the schools in the region, Broward County, Dade County, were staging walkouts, were engaged in a lot of activism. And the kids in Liberty City, the part of Miami where there are the highest rates of shootings and deaths, were threatened with expulsion. Expulsion. For marching, for protesting. And then the kids in other parts of Broward County that were marching, some of them met with some of the Parkland students to participate, were blasted all over the news, national news, is aren't they brave? Aren't they brave? And what people didn't know is that their school administrators had kind of done a wink, look the other way. They'd already given them some warnings that there would not be severe punishment if they chose to walk out. And this one. So Charlene Carruthers, she's the leader of BYP 100, one of the groups that is of the many that drew itself out of the movement for Black Lives. She wrote on Twitter, "Gosh, this is amazing. And I'm not being sarcastic. I have to be honest and say that I'm a bit taken aback and a bit hurt that those of us who were in the streets in the past 5 years for Black Lives didn't receive this type of reception or public support." And there's a very long article that talks about and almost like kind of places the students who are engaged in the Dream Defenders movement against the students who are engaged with Parkland. Dream Defenders is an organization, and I will fully admit I'm a bit biased in support of them, and that I work closely with them. But Dream Defenders created itself after Trayvon Martin's murder, and out of the anguish the community felt, and organized, and has been organizing ever since. And part of their organizing was 30 straight days of occupation of the state legislative body. 30 straight days lobbying and pressing for gun control and reforms. 30 straight days.
demanding for some type of protection for young students, and they didn't get anything. And they were represented as terrorists. What I'm holding up is a book that just came out by Patrice Collier. She's one of the three women who started the movement for Black Lives, and speaks as to how common and how often it is that particularly Black women, but of those in the movement are accused of being terrorists. These young people, these many of them teenagers, doing the very same thing, moving from anguish and pain to demand change. And many did stand with them. You know, you see the articles, "Would you march with me?" Yes, many did. Many did march with us. I laugh how I was like up in where Smith College. That
Massachusetts.
Yeah, Massachusetts. I was up in Smith College area and I'm like, there are more Black Lives Matter signs here than Oakland. There are definitely many people of white privilege who did march with us. But that was a moment. Who's there for the movement? Who's been sticking it through? Because Charlene has been, and Patrice has been, and many others have been. And so back to my friend Max, he's an organizer in Miami, and he had noted that there was a lot of pressure. A lot of people wanted him to write a scathing criticism of the organizing around Parkland and the fact that it was resulting in an influx of criminalization and many of these gun control laws. There is a lot of concern that it's just going to result in greater criminalization of Black, brown, and Black children. He said, I couldn't do it. And I'm feeling rage. And I feel that was a practice in right speech and wise speech, because he recognized that he's feeling this rage, but he knows, first of all, that it would be used against him. It would be used against us. And thirdly, that this is something that is to everyone's benefit, everyone's awakening. And if it took a speech in 1850 to activism in the 60s, to protests and mobilizing 10 years ago that continues through, if it took the power of a gender-based uprising of Me Too to link enough people to actually think through violence and safety in new ways, then it's worth it. And so I wanted to Rachel Gilmer, I wanted to wrap up quickly. Rachel Gilmer is one of the co-founders of Dream Defenders. And so if you don't get a chance to read the articles, I really would encourage you to do so, because I realize I live in this weird warped like thing where I assume everybody
everybody reads the same junk that I do, and now we live in this news thing where all news is targeted to you, right? So.
But the links have been shared. But there's just there's a lot out there that is playing on this pitting, this black, white, you know, the privileged Parkland students, the Black Lives Matter folks, and, you know, why didn't they? And it's, you know, you start wondering if Russia's behind some of it. But it is... Rachel, who's one of the co-leaders of Dream Defenders, remember, a person who's been doing this for years, a person who drafted a letter immediately to the students in Parkland, and it took them some time to get back because they had to go through all of their press people. This is an organization that has been working and organizing in response to Trayvon Martin's murder, and does not in any way have the resources in all of those years that the students have been able to secure in just 2 weeks. They have an operating board. They have a board of directors. They have 501c3 status. They have a very strong, flourishing budget. I work in this field. There are very few organizations of color who can do that even in a year, let alone 3 weeks. So she's feeling this, right? She's living there. She knows these people, and this is what she writes. The students who organized and participated in today's march grew up in a political climate set in motion by organizations like Dream Defenders, Black Lives Matter, and the Movement for Black Lives, an umbrella group for several organizations that work for the rights of people of color. My generation of protesters developed our movements on the foundation put in place by the Black Power and anti-war activism that came before us. And 5 years ago, these students watched a group of young Black and brown people take on the NRA and state legislature by occupying Florida's Capitol for 31 days, demanding a special session on Florida's Stand Your Ground law. We shouldn't conflate the bias in the Parkland students' reception with the students' own politics. These kids are smart. They don't have to be told that they have privilege, and they've been among the most vocal in calling attention to the plight of communities of color. She opened it up by saying 1 in 3 students protested today. The largest national student protest since the Vietnam War. You can't deny it. And what she's chosen to remind us is that we actually all take ownership of it. That even though, yeah, the numbers don't bear out, the folks up at that podium pose so little risk of being victims of gun violence. It happened. It was tragic. It rarely happens, though. Mass shootings rarely happen. And when they actually happen mostly in homes. Mass shooting defined as shooting more than 4 people, but that's a whole other story I won't get into. But it did happen to them, and they're mourning, and everyone who's been through it understands that pain, and that they're not the ones to be attacked. So what did the Buddha say about guns? Not a lot, from my memory. I know in right effort and wise effort, gun manufacturing is one of the jobs that he was not all too cool about. And ironically, that's where folks like the Dream Defenders see us all connecting. We may not agree about the cops. We may not agree about who's a victim. But she says where we all agree is that no one should make one more dollar off of the death of a child.
And so they are choosing to focus very much more on the manufacturing side, the corporate side. They're addressing it all, and many organizations are. But that does give me hope to move beyond this interpersonal infighting that sells papers for corporations, to recognize the wounds are real, that our solutions have been co-opted, our organizing has been, and now our suffering almost is. But one of my favorite quotes from Octavia Butler in the parable of the sower is, all that you touch, you change. All that you change, changes you. The only lasting truth is change. God is change. All that you touch, you change. All that you change, changes you. The only lasting truth is change. God is change.